Our guest joining us for this half hour is Linda Sarsour, a community organizer, co-chair of the Women's March, and the co-founder of Empower Change, the largest Muslim-led social and racial economic justice organization in the United States. Just this past weekend, of course, we have been witness to a series of horrific events, including the mass shooting of 11 congregants at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. The alleged perpetrator of those events, Robert Bowers, was very clear in his intention, reportedly stating that he intended to kill all the Jews. He is not only a white, he's a white supremacist, according to his posts on social media, according to his statements. And his posts on social media were not just limited to Jews. They were also included immigrants. And he also reposted another white supremacist post that read, "It's the filthy, evil Jews bringing their filthy, evil Muslims into the country," and it goes on and gets worse even from there. The anti-Muslim rhetoric is, of course, not unique to Robert Bowers and has been increasingly a part of our social sphere increasingly over the last several years. But also it's important to highlight tragically that the shooting at Tree of Life Synagogue is not the only attack at a house of worship in recent years. There is also 26 people killed at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas in 2017, 9 people killed at a historic black church in South Carolina in 2015, and 6 people killed at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin in 2012. To help us make sense of these devastating events is Linda Sarsour, again, co-chair of Women's March, co-founder of Empower Change. Thank you so much for being with us, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with your reaction, your feelings this weekend upon hearing the tragic news from Tree of Life Synagogue.
As a person of faith and as an American, I was horrified. My heart was shattered to think that people who were in worship, in their sanctuary, in their house, in the house of God, were massacred at the hands of hate. But my heart was already shattered the entire week as another white supremacist tried to get into a black church, found the doors locked, and then went down the street to Kroger supermarket and killed 2 African-Americans in their 50s as they were shopping, including one of them who's a grandfather that was with his grandson that watched his own grandfather get shot. And then I watched a pipe bomber who had sent pipe bombs to multiple Democratic leaders and opponents of the administration, who was also a Trump supporter and a white supremacist and had white supremacist ideology. And then we went into a mass shooting at a synagogue. And so for me, this has been a horrific week, and really just all of us together trying to make sense of it all.
Can you talk about that, the making sense of it all? Where has this taken your thinking?
I'm an intersectional organizer, and what I'm starting to understand is that hate is also intersectional. And you were very clear when you explained the reason why Richard Bauer particularly targeted the Tree of Life Synagogue. He could have went to any synagogue, but he specifically chose a synagogue that has been very publicly vocal in support of immigrants and refugees, has supported organizations like HIAS, which is a Jewish organization that resettles refugees, and from his social media posts was specifically concerned with the messaging coming from that synagogue around supporting and welcoming Muslim refugees and Muslims. So it was an intersection between anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. So it really hit hard. It was already horrific, the attack on Jewish congregants, but to know that they were also targeted for being good people and having common decency and supporting immigrants of all backgrounds just even made it more horrifying.
The president said when he was asked as part of his criticism of the caravan, he was asked by reporters to identify, you know, why he was opposed to the caravan. And one thing he had said was, quote, "the caravan includes Middle Easterns," unquote. You know, what do you think he was? What did that say to you?
So the president and the administration are master distractors and are masters at dog whistles. So what they were trying to do in that moment by using that type of messaging is basically reframe this issue of the caravan from asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution, drug cartels, and violence in Central American countries to making it a national security and counterterrorism issue, which he knows will then basically calm the American people down as they then put troops on the borders by saying, look, there are, quote, unknown Middle Easterners that could be amongst the caravan, which really is AKA Muslims, right? And even Vice President Mike Pence, when asked about that, because there is no evidence anywhere that there are, quote, unknown Middle Easterners amongst the caravan, he said, look, when we look at the number of people that are part of the caravan, between 3,000 to 5,000, there's bound to be. Like, it's a very illogical, irrational, estimate or even statement that comes out of no evidence. So I hope that the American people are understanding that this administration is engaging in divisive rhetoric. They're basically pinning us, Muslims and people from the Middle East against immigrants, particularly Central Americans who are seeking asylum. And I'm not distracted. I understand exactly what this administration is doing. And not only are they doing that, but they're also reaffirming some of the bigoted ideology that some in our country hold that is then translating into actual violence against people. And this administration has to take responsibility for them. The pipe bomber was clearly a Trump supporter. The Richard Bauer, just looking at his social media posts, clearly has been radicalized by the rhetoric reaffirmed by the president of the United States of America. And I hope that on Tuesday, November 6th, that we come together as a country and vote against xenophobia and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and hate. And what I also want people to understand, and I think this is very important, is that the foundation of white nationalism and white supremacy is actually anti-Semitism. That is actually the foundation of that ideology. And then on top of that, they put some building blocks: anti-Black racism, xenophobia, homophobia, Islamophobia, transphobia. So we have to understand that we have to be intersectional and see the connections that are happening, that we're actually all in this together. Jews in particular, and particularly conservative Jews, have to understand that their allies, their closest allies right now, are marginalized groups: LGBTQ people, Muslim communities, Sikh communities, progressives, and those of us who are fighting the resistance or fighting in the resistance against this administration.
Can you talk about that, the coming together of these communities? Because that did seem to be, you know, the one of the lessons of many years of confronting these hate-filled actions and violent actions has not been a separating of communities, but rather coming together. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly? And how has that come about, if that is the case?
We have no choice. That has to be the way in which we respond to hate, to divisiveness, to violence in this country. You know, as many folks know, I'm trained in Kingian nonviolence. I'm a nonviolent activist in this country. But I tell people all the time that nonviolence is not passive. That in fact, nonviolence is response and resistance is very powerful. And it requires for us to engage in acts of solidarity. And when I say solidarity, for me, solidarity is a verb. It's not just saying, wow, this is really horrible, and I'm just gonna send thoughts and prayers, which are very important. But what other things can we do? What other acts of meaningful solidarity can we do for one another? And right now, in light of the Tree of Life synagogue shooting, Muslim Americans joined together, led by my organization, Empower Change, and an organization called Celebrate Mercy, in raising funds. We raised about $160,000 in support of the families and the victims of the Tree of Life shooting. Our original goal was to raise $25,000 just as a gesture of our solidarity. And we surpassed that over six times because the generosity of the Muslim community and our allies towards our Jewish sisters and brothers. We also have raised over $40,000 for HIAS, which is an organization that has dedicated the last few decades to resettling immigrants from all over the world, not Jewish immigrants, but immigrants of all backgrounds, showing up at synagogues on Fridays, and people already preparing to show up for Shabbat. services to protect synagogues across the country, showing up to direct actions that are happening across the country, whether they be vigils or direct action or rallies in support of our Jewish sisters and brothers. We have to be loud. And I say to people, even if you are sitting at home and saying, this is really horrible, this should not be happening, that is not enough. Your dissent has to be public. Your solidarity has to be public and send a message that we will not stand by when these things happen to Black people, to LGBTQ people, to Muslim people, and to Jews.
When people look not just at the events that are happening here in the United States, but around the world right now, there is a rise in governments that are being led by anti-immigrant, autocratic, in many cases, I think what many have labeled fascists or verging on fascist regimes. Can you put these actions of this past week in the context of these international events as well?
Absolutely. I mean, people have to understand that there's a lot of American exceptionalism. We kind of look at ourselves as a country in some sort of exceptional way. But in fact, the rising right is happening all across the West and all across South America. Recently, the election in Brazil, where they elected a president that's even more far to the right than Trump. And we think Trump is the worst of them all. In fact, Brazil has showed us that it could even be worse. We're watching the rise of the right in Europe and in places like Germany, and really understanding that this is, if we don't stand up, if we don't understand this larger kind of rise of the right around the world and connect with our counterparts across the Atlantic, something really bad's going to happen, and we cannot let that happen in our lifetime. We know what happens when the far right is in power, when they have all the power. And that's why when we see these kind of small incidents happening around the country, that we don't look at things individually or in a vacuum. This is part of what happens when the far right is in power. Violence happens against communities, particularly targeted communities. So it's not just random people, but in fact, it targets Jews. It targets people who are minorities like Black people and immigrants and refugees and Muslims and anyone who is not white and Christian. And so we have to understand that. So for me, I don't just look at the United States and say, wow, what a phenomenon. I look at the United States and say, okay, what's happening here that's also happening in Germany? What's the common denominator? And I don't know if people know this. Steve Bannon has been in places like Europe. He's been helping and advising many of these far-right parties across Europe. And I wouldn't be surprised to know if he had his hands in helping the far right in a place like Brazil. So I think that the American people just need to understand that this is not just about intersectionality here in the States, but understanding that we are actually connected across the globe. And we have to look at this as a global issue that could harm people across the world.
And we see in places like in Hungary, in Germany, in across Europe, a very particularly virulent anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant actions, not just rhetoric, but actions. Is there a coming together internationally? Do you feel that this organizing is happening in response, that the organizing to support the Muslim community, to support immigrants, to support refugees is able at this point to, you know, go toe to toe with the rising of the right?
There definitely is initiatives and partnerships. I mean, political kind of coalitions like Podemos in Europe and the Labour Party in the UK and other groups that are really trying to figure out how to make their voices louder and engage in action to protect immigrants. As you saw in Europe, there have been many groups that have stepped up to support the resettlement of Syrian refugees, literally meeting people on the shores of places like Greece and many European countries that have actually taken more refugees than the United States has taken in. So I definitely see that opportunity. I think the challenge is that we're in shock factor, that we're literally all in reactionary mode right now in our own countries. The same things that you're describing that are happening in places like Hungary and Germany are actually happening right here in the United States of America, separating children from their families on the borders, literally putting children in cages. We woke up to hear that the President of the United States thinks that he could amend the Constitution of the United States of America through an executive order basically stopping birthright citizenship for any child who was born in the United States of America, which is actually the 14th Amendment. We are seeing everything that we were afraid of as we looked across the seas is happening right here in our country. And what makes it really horrifying is that the United States of America is supposed to be the leader of the free world. What goes here goes everywhere else, which is why the American people have to understand that it is our responsibility to be loud, to be organized, and to resist this type of bigotry, hatred, and xenophobia, this white nationalism and white supremacy, because if we allow more horrible things to happen, it basically gives the check mark to every other country in the West and South America to say, oh, well, if they're doing it in the United States of America, then we can do that here in our country. So that's really, we're in a very urgent and critical moment. And a lot of people, I when I'm in spaces with folks, people say, you know, if I lived at the time of the Holocaust, I would have done this and I would have done that. If I lived at the time of the civil rights movement here in the United States of America, you know what I would have done? I would have done this and I would have hit slaves and I would have done that. I'm asking you, what are you doing right now? Not what would you have done 50 years ago and 60 years ago and 70 years ago, but what are you willing to do in this moment? Because we're actually on, in my opinion, on the cusp of something really horrible to happen. And we have an opportunity. I don't believe liberation comes at the hands of the ballot box, but I do believe we can stop some of the hemorrhaging on our communities by having one branch of government at the least, at the very least, who can kind of create some checks and balances on this administration. So I'm asking people November 6th, you're not going to find a perfect candidate because they will never exist, but I'm asking you to vote collectively, vote for Black people, vote for Muslims and Jews and Sikhs and refugees and LGBTQ people and marginalized people in this country, women and people with disabilities. I'm counting on people to send a mandate, not just to vote, not just to win, but to really come out in overwhelmingly large numbers and send a mandate to this administration that we will not sit back, that we are the majority, and we will not stand by idly while hate and division and fear-mongering is literally fracturing our nation.
And our guest right now is Linda Sarsour. She's a Palestinian Muslim American born in Brooklyn. She was co-chair of Women's March and co-founder of Empower Change, the largest Muslim-led social and racial economic justice organization in the United States. Linda, in this election, women organizing, women raising money, women running as candidates have been at a historic high and a historic element in pushing what's happening in these midterms. And many people are crediting that organizing of women as originating or at least being significantly propelled by the Women's March. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the organizing that went into making the Women's March happen and how you see that continuing to play out in politics since then?
Absolutely. I mean, as folks know, the January 21st, 2017 march, which was the day after the inauguration of the President of the United States of America, was the largest single day demonstration in American history. And it propelled women across the country to see that, yes, we too have power, that women have power. And we were able to not only gather 1.2 million people in Washington, D.C., but over 2.5 million across the country, in addition to the 1.2 million, which is over 3 million people in the United States and over 6 million globally. We had people across the world who were in solidarity with us in the United States. And out of that Women's March, over 20,000 women have stepped up in the United States to run for offices anywhere from school board all the way to the U.S. Senate. And what we saw in the Democratic primaries is over two-thirds of those who ran in the primaries and one were Democratic women. And that makes us very proud that all of a sudden, social workers and school teachers and activists and organizers and even some stay-at-home moms said, you know what, I am the change that I need to see in this country, that we're not waiting for leaders, that we're going to stand up. And women continue to organize ever since the Women's March. We led the largest single-day civil disobedience led by women back in June around the issues of family separation. Over 700 women got arrested in Washington, D.C., standing up to Congress and this administration. As you know, Women's March was one of the lead organizations on the organizing against Kavanaugh nomination in Washington, D.C. I was the first protester to get arrested in that hearing room that day and wanted everybody to know whether or not we knew that the kind of cards were stacked against us, but we wanted to record in history that women stood up, that women did not sit back idly while this administration stole the Supreme Court from us. And I'm telling you right now, we're coming back. Not only have we been engaged in electoral work across the country in very important states like Florida and Georgia and Michigan and Wisconsin and North Carolina and et cetera, we're also coming back to Washington, D.C. on January 19, 2019. One of the most important messages that we have is that this administration thought that the Women's March was a one-hit wonder, that the women can only organize that one time. We're coming back again, and this time it's even more critical than when we went the first time. Because when we first went, it was people were outraged that we elected a president like Trump, but we weren't exactly sure what in fact he was capable of. And he has shown us in the last almost 2 years what he is capable of and what his administration is capable of. He was our worst nightmares manifested, and we're coming back to Washington, D.C., and hopefully what will be another largest single demonstration in U.S. history to show him and the administration and Congress that we are the majority, that we will hold them accountable, and we will nonviolently resist this administration at every single level as they continue to target, again, immigrants and Muslims and Jews and people with disabilities and women and Black people in America.
Can you talk about, you know, how devastating was it for that the loss on Kavanaugh? As you said, you were the first person arrested in protesting Kavanaugh. It was a key organizing moment for women who had been inspired by Women's March to be organizers, and many women came together on Kavanaugh. How profound was then his confirmation?
I mean, I am still distraught. Like, I have not yet gotten over his nomination. I mean, it was absolutely despicable and horrific. And the messaging that went out basically to young girls all over the country that you don't matter, that in fact, you are not to be believed, and really discouraging women around the country from telling their stories. While I was in Washington, D.C. for literally an entire month organizing against the Kavanaugh nominations, I heard horror stories of women across the country, women who were white, privileged, middle class. I also heard from poor white women who came from places like Nebraska and Maine and other states around the country. I heard from Black women and Latina women and women literally of every background who had a story to share. And some of them have never, ever shared their stories ever before. And this administration basically said, we don't care what you think. Republicans in Congress and the Senate Judiciary Committee did not care what these women had to say, what any woman had to say. So we are as a women's movement, are in a very pivotal moment. And the question is, do women have power? Will we have power? How will we leverage our power? And we hope to leverage our power at the ballot box. We hope to leverage our power in mass demonstrations, like on the Women's March on Washington in 2019, and continue to build power. One of the things that I say to people all the time, that organizing with the Women's March is not easy. There are many women who've never organized together, ever. Who are coming together, because our philosophy is unity is not uniformity. We don't have to agree on every political issue. We don't even have to be from the same political party. Like, I'm not a loyal Democrat. People think I'm some, spokesperson for the Democratic Party. And I'll tell you right now, I'm not. And I don't think the Democratic Party wants me to be a spokesperson for them. I am a person who believes that everybody deserves to live with dignity and respect in this country, and that we have a right to disagree on political issues. But we should live safely and freely. And if you agree with that, I think that the Women's March is a place for you to come organize.
Okay. Linda, I'm going to have to interrupt you and stop us there, because our clock is almost out. Thank you so much for joining us. Linda Sarsour, co-chair of Women's March and co-founder of Empower Change. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.